Welcome to DCEKG, where we diagnose Washington's policy issues and prescribe needed solutions. Here are your hosts, Eric Ulan and Joe Grogan.
Welcome back to DCEKG. I'm Joe Grogan alongside Eric Ulan. Today, we're diving back into our conversation with Bill Hammond. Bill, when we ended part one of our conversations, we started talking about the New York nursing home scandal with Governor Cuomo, and this was a subject of tremendous scrutiny of Cuomo. He had been riding high with an Emmy Award for his press conferences around COVID, and then the nursing home scandal hit, and it really precipitated a relatively rapid decline in him, in his political career, which he's now trying to rehabilitate. But you were beginning to describe your take on how it came to be that Governor Cuomo made the decision to that precipitated the scandal with patients. Do you want to just describe, because a lot of the criticism has been that this was strictly economic in motivation, and you have a slightly different take on it.
Yeah, I mean, that decision came out in March 25th, 2020. Really, the scariest period of the pandemic in New York City, when the numbers were going up ferociously, and there wasn't a clear end in sight. I think, in retrospect, unbeknownst to people at the time, the infection rate was already coming down by March 25th. At least that's what some of the retrospective estimates indicate, but they had neither Governor Cuomo or anyone else had any way of knowing that, just because our surveillance technology was so limited and testing was so limited. All we knew is that the hospitals were filling up, and they were filling up really rapidly, and the governor was focused on creating more capacity in hospitals because there was some fear that hospitals would become completely overwhelmed. And in that context, the hospitals came to Cuomo and said, listen, we have a cohort of patients who are ready to leave. They've gotten past the worst of the virus, but they need a nursing home placement. They're elderly, they're frail. Maybe they came from a nursing home in the first place. And the nursing homes won't take them from us because they're still positive for the virus, and the nursing homes don't want the virus in their facilities. Can you please order the nursing homes to take these people off our hands? And that'll free up some beds for critically ill patients. That was the pitch, I believe, to the governor. And the governor accepted it, and the health department issued its order on March 25th. There were a bunch of things he could have done better. He could have notified the nursing homes that this was about to happen. He could have offered them support for, you know, advice on how to handle these patients, equipment, you know, PPE and that sort of thing to make it more possible. He didn't do that. Thousands of these patients were transferred into nursing homes. They were infected. The extent to which they added to the crisis in nursing homes is hard to measure because it was such a chaotic situation. And then he compounded that by not properly disclosing how many people were dying in nursing homes. He was withholding about a third of the fatalities. All of this was kind of going on in the background. He was taking a lot of questions about the situation in nursing homes. He was responding to them in a very defensive and sometimes aggressive way. He was trying to shift blame to the Trump administration, but it wasn't really denting his popularity. His popularity was absolutely soaring at that point because of his daily briefings. He had a national fan base. There were people who were calling themselves Cuomosexuals, if you remember that. And he also took the opportunity at that moment to write a memoir. It was kind of remarkable hubris in retrospect that he would kind of take a victory lap for his masterful leadership in that situation when the situation wasn't even over yet. But he wrote the memoir kind of in the spring and summer of 2020. It was published in the fall. That came out in October, and then he won an Emmy, as you mentioned. He won an Emmy for his, it was kind of an honorary Emmy ad hoc based on his daily briefings. And that was, I believe the Emmy was in December of 2020. So the crisis was actually getting worse again. So the infection rate and the hospitalization rate and everything kind of bottomed out in the summer, but then it started creeping back up in the fall, and around the holidays, it started spiking again. So the virus had come back in spite of the governor's masterful leadership, and he was under increasing pressure from various forces to release the true data on the nursing homes, which he continued to resist. And then as I believe we talked about last time, the Empire Center had a lawsuit. Well, the Attorney General put out a report saying that the governor was misleading the state about the fatalities in nursing homes. The health department released updated totals, but still didn't give kind of the granular data about when and where these deaths happened. The Empire Center won its FOIL lawsuit in early February of 2021. And so that put the health department in a position of finally having to release the complete data. And in the last hour of the last day, like they had a deadline, I think it was February 10th, they had to release the data. They summoned critics in the legislature, people who had been upset about this situation. They summoned them to a Zoom meeting with Melissa DeRosa, the governor's top aide. And they tried to sell the people on that Zoom call on the idea that, well, the real reason we were withholding that data is because we didn't want to give ammunition to the Trump administration. The Trump administration was trying to attack us, trying to undermine us because we were so popular and they viewed us as a threat. And so we withheld that data because we were afraid of what they were going to do with it. I don't think that went over well with the people on that Zoom call, certainly not with all of the people on that Zoom call. One of them was Assemblyman Ron Kim, and he went public and he said this, you know, what they said didn't make any sense. I still think they handled this badly. He criticized them. And the governor called Ron Kim, the Assemblyman, and screamed at him on the phone and said, if you come at me, I'm going to come at you. I'm going to accuse you of corruption. So he was threatening this Assemblyman. It was kind of a type of behavior that Cuomo was notorious for at that point. He was, you know, he'd been in office for 10 years. And he was used to getting his way. He was used to intimidating members of the legislature because he did have a lot of power over them. But Ron Kim went public and said, The governor just called me up and screamed at me because I criticized his nursing home policy. And that kind of broke the ice because there was this built up resentment of the governor's bullying tactics, his you know, the way he would use his leverage over legislators. And so more and more members of the legislature kind of took Ron Kim's side. The governor did kind of come at Ron Kim and accused him of corruption in a press conference very publicly. But the sort of official Albany was siding with Ron Kim because members of the legislature knew that they'd had similar experiences with the governor and his team. And so they recognized what was going on. And for once, they decided, OK, we're standing up against that kind of behavior. We have a right as legislators to say what we think. And around that same time, these accusations of sexual harassment started to bubble up. And the governor and his people responded to those with some bullying tactics as well, where they leaked details of the employment file of one of his accusers, which is sort of, you know, at the top of the do not do list for sexual harassment response is, you know, leaking details from the personnel file of an accuser.
Right.
That's called retaliation, or at least it looked an awful lot like retaliation. And that's how it was received by the governor's growing body of critics. And so that really caught fire. You also had resentment over the way he had written his memoir, where he had used public resources to write the memoir. And he, after promising not to, there was resentment over his early in the pandemic, he had allocated testing to high-ranking officials, but also members of his family. You know, there's a suspicion that he was using that again to gain leverage over people. He was saying, listen, I have access to COVID testing. Everybody wants COVID testing. I can arrange a COVID test for you, but you know, you have to be nice to me. That was kind of the implied message.
So I love this story because for a number of reasons, but one, as an Albany native, Albany politics, as grotesque as it is, still fascinates me. Two, the fact that watching it, the Empire Center's tenacity in going after the data and not just accepting the excuses and filing suit and the FOIA request and filing suit to get the data put pressure on the Cuomo administration, sort of crack things open, and they come up with this lame excuse that they didn't want to give ammo to the dreaded Trump administration, which at that point in December had lost, like that excuse. And it sort of started this avalanche of other, like, people saying, yeah, Cuomo is arrogant and he's been driving me nuts for too many years. He's gotten too big for his britches. And then it snowballs all these scandals. Now, New York has lost how many politicians over these various investigations, weaponized or, I mean, Spitzer taken out over a prostitution scandal. You lost Attorney General Schneiderman. The majority leader Bruno was taken out. Ultimately, that was overturned by the Supreme Court, but there was a prosecution for...
He resigned because of that scandal.
Right. But ultimately, he was convicted and it was the Supreme Court that overturned him. But it's like New York has this pattern of, oh, and Sheldon Silver, the longtime Democratic head of the New York State Assembly.
Alan Hevesy, the former state controller.
Right.
He was convicted in a pay-to-play scam. At one point, there was something like 5 or 6 Senate majority leaders in a row who had major scandals with criminal charges. That was... Some of them were very short-lived majority leaders, but we have a pattern in Albany of corruption and scandals, and it's happened to have taken out a lot of our high-ranking officials in recent history. There's just no question about it. I used to keep a list as a reporter. I used to keep kind of a tabulation of all the... If you start including members of the Assembly and Senate, it gets to be a very long list.
Right, but it's also people... It's not just the corruption. It's as if there is a particular, it looks like politicians who are continually get reelected by, like Sheldon Silver was never going to lose that seat, right? Bruno kept winning. Cuomo was still popular and probably would have won reelection in a state where Democrats are so dominant. And then an investigation comes in and blows these people out that the electorate keep sending back to Albany in high-ranking positions. Now you see this situation with Letitia James going after Trump after she campaigned on the made it a campaign issue that she was going to go after Trump. It's like New York has a pattern of not just corruption that takes out politicians, but also prosecutions that take out popular politicians. Do you think that's just a crazy perception on my part, or is that actually accurate too?
You know, there have been attempts to kind of quantify that and to compare us to other states. It's very difficult because every corruption scandal is unique in some ways. But New York does seem to have a concentration of these scandals. It may be because there's a couple of theories people have. One is that the you happen to have the largest city in the country is in New York, and it's also the media center. So you have all of the major networks and the biggest newspapers are based in New York City. And so they've kind of taken a special interest in local politics. Another thing is that you have probably the most prestigious U.S. attorney's office. And maybe, I don't know if this is true too, but like it seems to have an awful lot of staff compared to a lot of U.S. attorney's office. So the Southern District of New York, based in Manhattan, is sometimes viewed as the most aggressive federal prosecutor's office. And they periodically, they take an interest in how things are going in Albany and signs of corruption there. And Preet Bharara, he became kind of a mini celebrity in his own right because of his crusading prosecutions involving the legislature. He investigated Cuomo at one point and then ended up dropping it without charges. So it could. Oh, and another thing is that the Capitol is located 180 miles to the north or 150 miles to the north of New York City. So it's kind of outside of the population center. It's isolated from those big media headquarters. And there's some thinking that maybe that creates a sense of insularity within the state government that in many respects, if you're elected as a city council person or as mayor in New York City, you are more famous in New York City, which is, you know, where a lot of the votes are. You're more famous than the governor and members of the legislature. It's often viewed as a more prestigious position to be an elected member of the city council than to be an assembly person because you have a larger district. So that historic decision to locate the state capital so far from the center of the population and the center of the economy, maybe that plays a role in the pattern of corruption as well.
Bill, thank you very much for all this. DC EKG loves the long form conversation and your explanation of what happened to Governor Cuomo during COVID and its aftermath. Just as Joe said, fascinating. Couple questions for you, given the long arc of Cuomo's career. After all, he's been a public individual since working for his father when his father was governor back in the starting in the early 80s. He is currently subpoenaed to come to Washington to explain himself in front of a House Select Subcommittee on the coronavirus, you know, for the decisions that he took. How is he attempting to frame his choices and his decisions and his kind of public policy record as he goes about examining whether or not he can rehabilitate his career? And then as well, taking a look at the Empire State and in particular health policy and the role that health policy and health spending has played, perhaps in impacting some of these notorious scandals that you've raised, as well as just a lot of public policy decisions made by the state here over the last 50 or 60 years. Kind of what, if anything, is New York State concluded about how it handled coronavirus and what lessons, if any, is it trying to apply for the future, especially given through the work that you do?
So this is a real sticking point for me, a sore point. The state doesn't seem to have learned anything. And it really doesn't seem to even have tried to learn anything. I mean, I'm speaking in kind of absolute terms, so there may be some small areas where the state's learned some lessons, but it has not done a systematic review of its pandemic response.
And why is that, do you think?
I should say the governor has commissioned a consultant study, which is currently 3 or 4 months overdue. They hired a consulting firm in Arlington, Virginia. They were very intent on finding a firm that had no involvement in the state's response, which makes sense. And I'm keeping an open mind about what that review is going to say and how good it's going to be. But I just don't think it didn't have subpoena power, for example. And it's reporting to the administration rather than to the public. And so I'm supporting legislation that calls for creating an independent commission established by the legislature, jointly appointed by the governor and the legislature. Outside experts would come in and do they would have subpoena power and they would do a really thorough investigation. But this is true also of a lot of other states and first and foremost, the federal government. Almost nobody has done a serious review of the pandemic response, which is a tragedy in the making because pandemics don't come along all that often and they're very difficult to manage. This was the first major pandemic in a century. And just think of all the technological changes that happened since the Spanish flu in 1918. Our society is so different. Our travel patterns are so different. Our living patterns, our social patterns, everything has changed. Plus, we have access to all this technology that can help us manage pandemics. We need to study what happened, figure it out in a very granular way, the same way we study a plane crash. To what extent was it pilot error? To what extent were there systems that need to be fixed? So it's just enormously frustrating to me that I think there's a political instinct out there that the pandemic was kind of a very divisive thing, and especially the responses, the interventions that the public health system resorted to respond to the pandemic became very divisive. The so-called lockdowns, keeping the schools closed, the masking requirements, the vaccine mandates, all of that became very divisive. And if you're trying to focus the electorate. You don't want to bring up a sore subject with the electorate. I sort of feel like, you know, that doesn't matter. You know, as a responsible public official, there's certain things you have to do regardless of the political consequences. And also, I think the politics could be good. If you're the politician who's standing up and saying, yes, all of that stuff was divisive. Our response was not good. We did not respond well. It was not happening on my watch. If you're Governor Hochul, you can say that. I was sidelined during the response. I'm going to be the one who fixes it. I'm going to be the one to make sure that we don't make those same mistakes again. And some of the policies they need to investigate are not the divisive ones. I mentioned earlier that, you know, part of the reason the governor ordered patients into nursing homes is that he had bad information about what was happening with the infection rate and how high hospitalizations were likely to go. He was in the same boat with everybody else in the country. Is there a way we could, so you've probably heard about this sewage testing that they're doing where they're looking for signs of the virus in effluent?
Yeah.
Is there a way we could do that routinely? Or could we have that system in place so that we can turn it on when there's a new virus coming up in some other country or some other part of the world, so we can get an early warning that, yes, it's here and it's spreading here? And could that technology be used to detect the rise and fall of different waves so that we would have a sense of where we were in the curve? Another big issue that came up was PPE. New York State had a stockpile, but when the time came, it had been neglected and most of the material in the stockpile was past its expiration date. Are we going to let that happen again? What are we doing differently to make sure it doesn't happen again? I don't think that would be a really divisive policy for the state to have a pandemic stockpile that it keeps up to date. These are things that I think need to be studied at the federal level too. New Jersey just released a study. It was commissioned by the governor, so it didn't have the level of independence that I think would be ideal. But I've read some of it, and it seems like they at least did their homework in terms of understanding what the important issues were and studying up on them and writing about them in a clear way. That's the kind of thing I think a lot of people should be doing.
Knowing the relationship between New York State and New Jersey, I know it was hard for you to say that New Jersey did some things marginally right here in the review, but it's a good observation. And yeah, it's a report that I would encourage everybody to take a look at. Back to Andrew Cuomo, though, for a moment, in terms of kind of where he is now. Like I said, he's ultimately going to have to come testify publicly in front of Congress, but he has been busy trying to frame and reframe his public policy career in anticipation of what nobody particularly knows. But give us your sense a little bit of kind of where his head is now, what he's trying to do, and what he might be trying to set himself up for in the future.
So he pretty clearly would like to get back into public life and in particular elective office. He and his people have floated various trial balloons. I think the one that has got the most legs is the idea that he would run for mayor of New York City. He periodically gives speeches and writes op-eds, and he had a podcast for a while. He's trying to carve out a place where he can rehabilitate his image. He does have a certain lingering... There's a cadre of kind of centrist Democrats out there who admire him, who you know, maybe became infatuated during the pandemic, or they just like his style of politics. He does have a kind of following. There's also a certain number of people who feel like he got a raw deal, especially on the sexual harassment charges. And it's interesting because there was a period where he seemed to be trying to emphasize the sexual harassment charges because...
What do you mean by that?
Well, I think he understood that that was the straw that broke the camel's back. That was the allegation he couldn't survive, or at least he decided he couldn't survive it. That was the thing that really kicked the interest in impeachment into high gear. When the impeachment, you know, went as more and more accusers came forward, more and more people came out in favor of him needing to resign or be impeached. There were people who felt that about the nursing home scandal, about the memoir scandal, about the other things that had gone on. But the sexual harassment thing seemed to be most salient. And I will say he's raised complaints about some of the accusers where what they were accusing of him of did not rise to the level of true harassment. That's his allegation. He's also raised, I think, legitimate questions about how the Attorney General handled her investigation. You remember she did a report basically substantiating the idea that he was guilty of sexual harassment. And that when that report came out, his days were numbered.
But you say so, his criticism of that report is legitimate. So what are those sorts of claims he's made about the report that are legitimate in your judgment, in your view?
So when the report came out, I believe the Attorney General gave a press conference and said, we find evidence that he sexually harassed 11 women. And 11 became, it was such a large number. It was a large enough number that it seemed like, well, he must be guilty, because even if you assume that five of them were lying, there's still six, right? The thing is, some of those 11 people were not employees of the state, and therefore sexual harassment wasn't really on the table for them. And some of them, it was a very passing incident where he ran into them at a wedding and gave them an inappropriate hug or something. These are not the kind of things that would come up in, you know, if the person who was being investigated was less prominent. I guess another complaint he has, which I think is less legitimate, is he never had a fair chance to respond to the charges. It was a very unusual situation for the Attorney General to investigate sexual harassment and then go public with her findings. And there was no real mechanism for any kind of hearing or adjudication of the findings. The mechanism that was available to him was to fight the impeachment, to take it to trial in the Senate. I think he viewed correctly that that was a losing proposition, and he resigned instead of facing that. But he and his people do have raised legitimate questions about some of the details of the accusations on the sexual harassment front. But the thing is, there's a difference between being technically innocent of sexual harassment and being politically innocent, right? Of being forgiven by the voters. You know, even if you just say, okay, that inappropriate hug didn't warrant dismissal if he had been a chief executive of a private company, you can still say it was obviously not appropriate behavior for a governor. If he had done the training, one of the things that came out is that he never took the training that he mandated as governor. If he had done the training, he would have known that some of the stuff he was doing was inappropriate. Some of the stuff he did when the accusations came out in terms of retaliation, that was inappropriate. So there were all kinds of, you know, whether it would have risen to the level of an impeachable offense, I don't know. You can debate that to the end of the, you know, the cows come home. But I think he does have some legitimate complaints about the process. That doesn't necessarily mean he should be governor again.
Well, and to your earlier observation about him, you know, the surmise that he might someday be a candidate for mayor in New York City, you've covered politics in the state and in the city for decades, as well as public policy research and advocacy. Do you think, based on kind of the current state of New York City politics and the current significant disapproval rate of the incumbent mayor, Eric Adams, do you think Cuomo has a crack at successfully running for mayor and becoming New York City's next mayor?
Well, wait a second. Adams now has a sexual scandal brewing. I mean, he's got again, back to this pattern of a high profile New York politician with some type of financial or sexual accusations against him. Adams getting softened up with some accusations against him as well. Sorry to interrupt.
It's a single accusation. It goes back to the 80s or 90s. He was a police officer at the time. And it's coming out, you know, obviously many years have gone by. And so, I have a certain amount of sympathy for that situation where, you know, an accuser comes out of the woodwork close to 30 years down the road.
It just fits the pattern.
It's going to be investigated and reviewed, and there's a legal process for it. So Joe's right. There's accusations against both sides on the table. A former incumbent governor who resigned in the face of accusations, a current incumbent.
But
does he have a crack?
I don't know that.
But Bill, does he have a crack? Okay.
Yeah.
That's kind of curious. Yeah.
The thing is that mayor's races tend to be like free for all primaries. And so you can, at least under the old system, you could win with a plurality instead of a majority. I think they've ranked choice voting now. And so that might mitigate that possibility of winning with a plurality. But when you have 6 or 7 candidates in a primary, it tends to dilute, like, it makes it hard to really find a clear choice, and a dark horse candidate can emerge in that situation. But so I just find it, you know, Spitzer tried to do the same thing. He tried to run for New York City comptroller, and he just didn't get any traction at all.
It's kind of remarkable that these guys can't figure out something else to do with their lives. I mean, I just don't get it after that they're willing to drag themselves through this again, especially when, I mean, in Spitzer's case, that was a pretty clear, ridiculously incontrovertible scandal he got wrapped up in, when he'd been such a high profile prosecutor for malfeasance in New York. And then he goes from attorney general to governor, which I just, as an aside, I do have a problem with these attorney generals in New York who campaign for the position, and then they use it for political purposes to then run for governor. You know, not that it does happen in other states, but it seems like it's a particular problem in New York that they are targeting people in order to launch themselves into higher office. I wouldn't mind seeing some type of constitutional amendment in New York where the attorney general was prohibited from running for governor for like 10 years after being attorney general to mitigate some of this stuff. But Spitzer gets wrapped up in this prostitution scandal where he was going down to New York, and then he arrogantly thinks he can rehabilitate himself. Cuomo's problem was arrogance as much as it was in any errors in judgment or out-and-out corruption. And now he's trying to rehabilitate himself. When you look at Kathy Hochul, how is she fitting into this mold? She's the first woman, a female executive, that New York has had in all, you know, breaking up this long record, checkered record with guys resigning. How's she doing? How's her popularity? Do you think she's getting groomed for higher office? And is she running into resentments in the Albany legislature and Albany scene for her arrogance, or is she pretty popular right now?
I don't follow polls that closely. My sense of it is that her approval rating is pretty low. She had a couple of good months, so it may be better than I remember, but she is not, I would not give her like high marks in terms of like her efficacy. Does not have the same forceful style that Cuomo does, which in some corners was a great relief, but she's been rewarded for her more collegial ways. She's been rewarded by the legislature sort of pushing her around. And that's toxic, right? For governors can't be seen to be pushed around. She was, they, for the first time in history, they rejected one of her Court of Appeals nominees. They've rolled over her opposition on a lot of issues that they've passed and, you know, without her input. To be fair, she's dealing with Democratic majorities in both houses of the legislature. And they're super majorities. So if they want to, if they have their act together, they could override her veto. She would have to have some bigger successes under her belt before she became a serious contender for higher office.
And how about the state of the Republican Party in New York? Is there any hope of a resurgence in the legislature? Are there any candidates that you see that are dynamic enough to make a legitimate run for governor anytime soon or mayor anytime soon? And or are they consigned, as they are in the city of Albany, to permanent minority status?
I think I'm inclined more to the long-term minority status theory of the case. There were some flickers of strength in a couple of recent election cycles. They capitalized on, you know, when the lines were redrawn after the 2020 census, the legislature got a little bit greedy. They drew obviously gerrymandered lines. The courts threw them out. The courts wrote fairer lines that gave Republicans a shot, and they picked up a couple of seats. Arguably, that swung control of the House of Representatives to the GOP. It certainly played a role in that. And so that was a big moment for the Republicans in New York. But I don't feel like they've consolidated that. I mean, maybe there's stuff going on that I'm not aware of, but it's... I know. I get another thing is that the Lee Zeldin, the candidate for governor in the last cycle, he came closer than people had thought he would come. I think it was right. A 7-point margin. But I just don't feel like they're starting at such a disadvantage at all levels of government or at all levels of the state government, I should say.
Right.
They're outnumbered. I guess their best hope is that Democrats will continue to flame out, you know, that they'll, I mean, you're seeing right now, the population of New York State is shrinking. It's literally shrinking. And the Democrats don't seem to have a great response to that. They don't seem to have a coherent set of policy proposals that's going to turn the state around in that regard. The economy is still kind of soft since the pandemic. People are leaving, and they've started the powers that be in Albany have started talking about an affordability agenda, but often that affordability agenda involves the state subsidizing things instead of making them more affordable.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's remarkable when you consider that Vermont is having population growth, tremendous population growth. So people aren't moving just because of the weather. I mean, upstate New York is as beautiful as anything in Vermont. And then you've got New York City as well. And to still have net population decline with a state, a bordering state that's doing so well is just absolutely astounding to me how that New York has been so mismanaged. So, Bill, what's next for the Empire Center? What are you guys focused on as far as what data are you looking for? What studies? Where are you guys going next? You've really made a name for yourself. A lot of people have been fans of yours for years, but through this COVID situation and a lot of the work you've done on healthcare and Medicaid financing and healthcare financing in particular, you've made a national name for yourself. What's next?
I mean, I mentioned before that I see a need for a thorough after-action review of the pandemic response, and so I'm doing a certain amount of advocacy around that, trying to get that to happen wherever it can happen. I'm doing a lot. I'm tracking our Medicaid budget is growing at some of the fastest rates that I've ever seen in my career. And it's not because, you know, things aren't necessarily peachy in New York, but the economy is growing and employment is rising. And so why would our Medicaid spending be spiking at this moment in our history? I'm trying to keep tabs on how the healthcare industry exploits the Medicaid system and identify areas of waste and even corrupt deals and highlight those. That's what my work is these days.
That's great.
That's a boatload both of work and opportunities for future conversations with you, because it sounds as if there's significant work that the Empire Center is doing that we will try to take advantage of in the future with discussions about challenges and opportunities, both for the problems in New York State, but also nationwide, and ways to cure some of these challenges, especially in the healthcare providing arena. I want to thank you for coming on the podcast today. It was a real pleasure. We'd like to thank our sponsor, Survivors for Solutions, our executive producer, John C.Z. Swartacki, our producer, Lauren Timmerman, our distribution partner, Big Wig Media, and our production team, Evergreen. On behalf of our podcast, DCEKG, along with host Joe Grogan, this is Eric Euland. We thank you for listening. We'll be talking.
This has been DCEKG. Be sure to subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts so you don't miss the next episode. While you're at it, leave us a rating and review to help others find out about the show.